Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. We have a huge amount of questions to answer, and I know as somebody who would wish to be a minister in the government after a general election, I know it won't be easy for any government, but I think people are listening to that argument from trade unions and taking it seriously because they know that these groups of workers are expressing a frustration because of what they've been through.
What we saw during the pandemic was a revelation really to us that a lot of people really don't like work. They're not that they're lazy and they don't like working, but the way that work has been structured has been antithetical to people's interests. They didn't like the 9-to-5 and they didn't think it was worth all the commuting, and they were proved to be right on the basis of that. They didn't like the way they were being treated as instruments of corporate will, told what to do.
Well, hello and welcome to this second episode of the Nowhere Office in partnership with Prospect. That's the trade union with over 155,000 members, scientists, technicians, engineers, and specialist roles across the public and private sectors. And today we look at the politics and practicalities of the modern workplace. And you heard there from two of our guests coming right up, Alison McGovern, MP, Shadow Employment Minister, and also Adrian Wooldridge, who is Bloomberg's global business columnist.
Yes, we've got another rich range of voices in this episode discussing the workplace, not just the politics of work, but the place of it and the problems and challenges of it. Here's another couple of voices that we're going to hear from.
So our existing building, we don't have a lot of width. So there's not enough shop front. So the reason why we were attracted to this one is because we've got loads of shop front, and it's about telling people who we are. When you look at our existing building, and if you walk past it, you wouldn't know that we're a trade union, you wouldn't know who we represent, you wouldn't know who our members are.
There are a lot of cases that were specifically related to COVID. So for instance, someone is vulnerable and they are given a management instruction to come into work and they refuse to on the basis that they're vulnerable and they are disciplined for it and they want to have that declared to be an act of discrimination. I've had seen a number of cases where people have allegedly become disabled as a result of long COVID. And so they are bringing disability discrimination claims, perhaps saying that the employer has failed to make reasonable adjustments to cater for their disability and the way that the disability manifests itself. I've seen people who have been disciplined, yes, for refusing to come into the office, even when they're not immunocompromised, but because they consider it an unsafe workplace.
So that was Hafsa Begum, Prospect's head of finance and estates, who took me on a wonderful hard hat tour of their new building, which we're going to come to shortly. And then Barrister Jamie Suskind, who you heard from in the last episode.
Someone to have on your side if you need it. And at the end of the programme, to help us synthesise what we've heard, we recorded some comments from Prospect's Andrew Pakes, that's the Deputy General Secretary and Director of Communications and Research, to ask what he has made of the issues which have come up in this programme. Just as this episode was being edited for broadcast, the members of Prospect voted by 80% in favour of industrial action on March the 15th. So it's a breaking story, an ongoing story, and that makes this episode all the more salient, you might say. Conflict resolution is the aim of negotiation, but sometimes escalation cannot be avoided. But on with the show, or on with the tour, as Julia met Hafsa Begum, who is Prospect's head of finance and estates, on Rochester Row in London SW1, a very grand central London address, to find out why the new build project may just be a blueprint for offices, and certainly trade union offices, of the future.
So here we are, a very noisy Rochester Row. If ever we think that work is not happening in cities, it's happening, isn't it? We're surrounded by white van men and women in taxis. I'm with Hafsa Begum, the Director of Estates and Finance for Prospect Union. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
You're looking nervous, but don't be nervous. And you're also looking glamorous, but we're about to put on boots and hard hat because this is your domain, isn't it? We're about to go into.
Yeah, I did say don't wear your best clothes because it's very dusty inside.
So. But it does look actually, the listeners can't see it, of course, that you actually have worn your best clothes. Now, take it away, Hafsa. Tell me what we're doing.
So we're going to walk around the site. So let's just try not to get run over. Come on, guys. Taxis always wait for me. So basically, it's this whole block from the start of this bit of pavement all the way to that bit. So we're now the freeholders of this entire block.
Which is how many sort of square foot? Give me the property type jargon.
So in terms of the office space, it's probably about 18,000 square feet.
Right. So not small.
No, it's not small. And we're making quite significant changes to it. So initially there was like Westminster, the previous owners, they had consent for a very large scheme, something like 25,000 square feet, but that wasn't within our budget. So we have applied for new consent for a slightly smaller scheme than what they had. So we're hopeful that we'll get consent from Westminster very soon.
And why did you, in this period of time where the data shows that quite a lot of people don't want to go back to the office, or they don't want to go back full time, or they don't want to go back in the way that they did before, especially in a commuter-based city like London, why have you taken on a whole new office?
I think we, even before the pandemic, we were looking at our estate. We had two large buildings. So we had a building with about 20,000 square feet that we were using in Waterloo that we're still there. And then we had another building, 12,500 square feet in Clapham. And both buildings basically combined had lots of excess space. So to go down to what will now be about 17,000-18,000 square feet, we're actually completely downsized. But I think that as an organisation, we're hopeful that we're still going to have that the occupancy that we need. So it's not about making people come in 5 days a week. We've completely gone hybrid. But it's more about using the space in an effective way that makes us come together, makes us work better, you know, and ultimately it's about taking the movement forward. So this is what the vision of this building is about.
Now, what's interesting is that you've accidentally timed it so that you're involved in what I call the great refurb. So it's not just the consolidation of space. It's that you're now engaged in designing a new space that people who work hybrid want. So in a minute, we're going to go in to the building. You're going to show me what that's going to look like. But take me where you would like to go next.
So our existing building, we don't have a lot of width. So there's not enough shop front. So the reason why we were attracted to this one is because we've got loads of shop front, and it's about telling people who we are. So when you look at our existing building, and if you walk past it, you wouldn't know that we're a trade union, you wouldn't know who we represent, you wouldn't know who our members are. And with this, I'll explain some of the stuff that we're going to do after, but we've got all of this. So from where that canopy is all the way to the end to basically, you know, go to town with our brand and our purpose and what we're trying to do in the movement, all of that.
And you want your members to feel proud of the place in the middle of London that is the headquarters, yeah? And
definitely.
Do you want them to actually come to this space? Is
Absolutely.
It going to be an event space, yeah, conference space?
So on the ground floor, so all along where we're walking now is basically going to be meeting and event and conference space. Once you get in, it's up to here, it's all going to be meeting space. These horrible looking windows are going to go, and we're going to get a new facade that sort of goes up to the first floor. So that's going to look amazing.
I mean, just to play devil's advocate, how trade union-y is it? Property development, landlords, it's loads of money, isn't it? I mean, do you feel you've got to play with the system in order to have your flagship building for your members? I mean, it's property is the belly of the beast, isn't it, really?
It is significant in terms of the strength it holds in our balance sheet, but actually what we're doing is giving our balance sheet more strength. So it's not like, you know, we're spending all of this money and it's going to go to waste. I believe, genuinely believe that London, you know, if you walked around December 2020, I remember walking around with Mike in London going, he was going, everything's dead. And I was going, you know what, my London's going to come back.
Mike Clancy, the General Secretary.
And I think I was right, because if you walk around now, and I know certain areas are still a bit lacking, but it is coming back, and it's coming back in a different way. It's coming back in a way where we're not packed on the trains like we were before the pandemic, but there's the middle of the week that's still busy. You've still got quite a good nightlife after work, kind of, which is promising. And then I think ultimately we're seeing people take up more and more spaces.
Well, let's go and see the bones of the building.
Before you go into the building, can I just say, Julia, that I'm deeply envious of your hard hat tour with Hafsa Begum.
As well you should be, Stefan. Envy is the word. I mean, I had the most interesting morning. And I have to say, I haven't met a more impressive project manager, actually, than Hafsa. Somebody who holds the purse strings, the deadline strings, manages with considerable diplomacy the relationships with subcontractors, local residents, and we'll hear the different requirements of actual desks in the actual office.
Because we work in hybrid, so I think this is the biggest change for our staff, because most people have their own desk. That's the biggest change, is you come in and you know exactly where you're going to sit, whereas you come in now and it's going to be somewhere different.
So you're going to be hot desk?
Yeah, well, what we're going to do is...
Even the big cheeses? Or are they going to have their corner office?
The big cheeses, right, battled to have their own offices. So they won, and I got cornered. But on this floor, we're going to have 48 desks and six offices and I think five meeting rooms. So it's quite a lot on the floor, and you can't tell because the space, because it's all empty, you can't really tell. You can imagine the space. We've got floor plans and 3D visuals that show how the space will look.
So you're really expecting a shift in working patterns, aren't you? That this building is going to be for the conference centre, for the quiet tete-a-tete meeting rooms. You've bought into hybrid and the end of the commute-based
absolutely. So
office life.
In New Prospect House, we have 174 people working out of there, roughly. But this has only got 108 desks, plus another eight for the senior management. But it is dependent on the way that we've done the configuration is dependent on the roles. So we did this whole exercise with everybody, literally, in the union, all the staff basically in the union, about how they work, what their role meant, what activities they need to do. And from that, we got our space plan. So that's where this has all come from. But we don't expect 108 people to be occupying the desk every single day. We still expect Mondays and Fridays to be relatively quiet. So we might get 60 people in on a Monday and a Friday, maybe it might be even more quiet. But then the middle of the week, we can probably have about 90 people occupying the building.
Well, Hafsa Begum, you've given us a really great insight into your nowhere office, your office to be, which is currently nowhere because it's a building site, but it will be what we call a nowhere office. And thank you for being on the nowhere office, Hafsa Begum. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, vivid stuff. It's interesting, isn't it, Julia, this whole question of judging how much office occupancy there will be.
Yes, and of course we're beginning to see now the full force of reduced office occupancy, something some of the biggest corporates denied would ever happen. HSBC halving its office space in London's Canary Wharf, for instance. But I'm reminded, as Hafsa spoke, about how office life itself has changed, as well as the office, of what Jamie Suskin, the barrister, told us about the kind of cases crossing his desk post-pandemic.
Yes, that's right. Let's have a short clip of Jamie again.
There are a lot of cases, and I've seen loads across my desk, that were specifically related to COVID. So, for instance, someone is vulnerable and they are given a management instruction to come into work and they refuse to on the basis that they're vulnerable and they are disciplined for it and they want to have that declared to be an act of discrimination. That's one example that's crossed my desk. Another is I've had seen a number of cases where people have become or allegedly become disabled as a result of long COVID. And so they are bringing disability discrimination claims, perhaps saying that the employer has failed to make reasonable adjustments to cater for their disability and the way that the disability manifests itself. I've seen people who have been disciplined, yes, for refusing to come into the office, even when they're not immunocompromised, but because they consider it an unsafe workplace. I've seen lots of kind of contractual disputes where people are trying to renegotiate contracts, whether it's the employer or the employee, to change working at home patterns. Some employees want the right to work from home, and they want it to be a right that's enshrined in their contract and that can't just be at the discretion or whim of their employer. And that's a kind of commercial negotiation that's taking place in a lot of workplaces just now. So COVID has given rise to a lot of different legal actions. I mean, what I would say is, in my experience, the fundamental determinant of employment litigation's ups and downs tends to be the market cycle. So employment law is kind of counter-cyclical. When things are going, and this is why people hate lawyers, when things are going roughly, people are more likely to be getting dismissed or having bonus disputes or having pay disputes and industrial action. And there will always be a kind of spot where people have enough confidence and enough cash to bring claims, but things are going badly enough that the stakes are so high that they feel the need to. That's quite a common thing for employment lawyers to experience.
What we're hearing quite a lot on our show, The Nowhere Office, is that experimentation is going to be required. People use this word iteration. You know, we don't know the answers, and every workplace is different in its own ways. I'm sure your cases tell you. What have we got to know? What have managers and employees and their representatives got to understand about this process of experimentation when presumably you might end up, without even meaning to, getting into grey areas or even crossing certain lines in terms of employment law, even though it's done perhaps with good intentions?
That's right. I mean, I think, and it's a very good way of thinking about legal disputes, often they don't come from bad intentions. So the employer reaches the view that the commercial and general cultural situation has reached a certain point and that things need to change within the organization. That is a view that might be made for commercial or cultural reasons, but that doesn't make it a legally valid view. So for instance, you can't say you decide that a group of people within your organization, you don't really want them anymore. You can't just make them redundant. You have to follow the legal procedures that are applied to making them redundant, even if, you know, everything points towards your business being better off without those individuals through no fault of their own. You still need to jump through the legal hoops. You might want to open up negotiations with employees, but they don't want it. Or vice versa. They might come to you with demands and expectations which are commensurate with their expectations. Working from home is the most common example. And the business might say, well, actually, we don't think that is right. The only boring lawyer answer I have to give is, you know, the law moves a lot slower than society and culture do. And you always have to be aware that sometimes you are applying slightly outdated legal norms, but they nonetheless are legal norms, and you have a duty under the law to follow them. And if you don't, there are going to be consequences. So I think a lot of people think that being able to just really passionately and coherently argue that things need to change is good enough. Whereas, of course, when you get into the cold, pale light of the employment tribunal, it often looks like people have just gotten carried away.
Jamie Suskin there, the barrister who handles, amongst other cases, a lot of employment litigation, grounding us, if you like, in the realities that wherever you work, flexibly or not, hot desk or not, the equality of treatment matters hugely, the upholding of rights.
Yes, indeed. So, on to our last big interview, and it's on the big picture, really, the rights, responsibilities and societal impact of the changes in work and the role trade unions play in all of this. And indeed the role of business and organisations in the public and private sectors. We convened two high-profile and high-achieving individuals to discuss this, who on the face of it ought to disagree, but as you will hear, there was quite a lot of consensus that crept in pretty early on.
So we were joined in their respective actual offices. I do love it when the Nowhere Offices goes to someone else's office, and even by Zoom, by Alison McGovern, who, in addition to being Labour MP for Wirral South since 2010, is the Shadow Employment Minister, and also by my Bloomberg colleague now, as I can say, Adrian Wooldridge, who's the global business columnist for Bloomberg. And in fact, previously, he covered the political beat at The Economist.
So let's begin actually with you, Adrian, because you've written a large opinion piece today. For anybody listening at the time, the today in question doesn't matter, but you've written a piece really about capitalism and its limitations and in favour of liberalism, and saying that the age of the big corporation and the big labour union is sort of had its chips. Is that right, Adrian? And if so, what do you mean?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the piece that I've written today is on Martin Wolf's new book on the crisis of democratic capitalism. And the central argument of the book is that things are going badly, both for democracy and for capitalism. They're going badly for democracy because we're not satisfying the needs, wants, desires, interests of large sections of the population. They're going bad for capitalism because it's being eaten away from within by a sort of rentier spirit. It's becoming much more of a rentier system. And the question is how you counterbalance what's wrong with capitalism, how you fix that. And the interesting thing about the trade union issue is that they don't appear in the book at all, as far as I can see. Not deliberately, but I think just by the fact that they're not doing that much. If you go back to the 1930s, go back to the great reforms of capitalism under FDR, what you were trying to do, one of the things that he was trying to do was to counterbalance the power of big business with the power of big labor, big trade unions, with the government in the middle sort of holding the ring. Now you have somebody, a very serious person, writing a very critical book on what's wrong with capitalism, very, very, very worried, angst-ridden book on what's wrong with capitalism. And in terms of the cures, the trade unions don't appear either as a counterbalance to the power of business or as a set of solutions to the problems that capitalism is going through. And I don't think that's a deliberate omission. I think it's just that they're not around as part of the debate for large numbers of serious economists.
But of course, Alison, they very much are around for serious debate. And in fact, we're in the middle of a moment of high vis for the trade unions where it comes to strikes. And one of the things we're interested in talking to people such as yourself and indeed doing these programmes with Prospect is because it's a much more sophisticated picture, trade union movement, in fact, than that. But at the very least, does Martin Wolf have it right that the trade unions are invisible? Presumably not.
It is a fascinating analysis that he has of the situation that we have lived through since the financial crash in 2008 and the kind of political fallout of that financial situation and the kind of shock to the system that many people faced, and how that revealed, similarly to other financial crises, a kind of fragile structure of living standards and other things underneath. And in some ways, I mean, the FDR situation, I think, is interesting because, of course, it was Francis Perkins as FDR's Labour Secretary who really put in place some quite transformatory programmes in the US that offered workers who were very, very vulnerable in American capitalism serious protections. And I would say this, wouldn't I? But it is a consistent theme of history that women's contribution to social change gets overlooked and written out. So putting that aside, I think where we are now is that we have trade union leaders, I think of Pat Cullen, Christina McEnany of Unison and the Royal College of Nursing, making, I think, an effective and forceful case on behalf of their members that they have dealt with this horrendous situation of the pandemic and that they're entitled to be listened to and to be heard on pay. And I think perhaps we are in a new situation, a more, I think you said, Julia, more nuanced situation, because the public, I think, are hearing that and understand it. We have a huge amount of questions to answer. And I know, as somebody who would wish to be a minister in the government, you know, after a general election, I know it won't be easy for any government, but I think people are listening to that argument from trade unions and taking it seriously because they know that these groups of workers are expressing a frustration because of what they've been through. And I think that's a different challenge to perhaps some of the tensions of the past.
And how visible and vocal are the unions, for example, on the Wirral, where you represent, Alison? How much are they part of the debate? How relevant are they, in particular to, you know, the precarious younger workers who perhaps face a lot of uncertainties? Does it occur to them to join a union?
Well, the new General Secretary of the TUC, Paul Novak, lives in Birkenhead down the road from me. So I think it's fair to say that on the Wirral, trade union and trade union leaders are pretty visible. But to the substance of your point is a fair one. I would say it really just depends who you're speaking to. I mentioned nurses before, not just nurses, but the whole of our health staff. And health is a big employer. I think they are at the coalface of this and understand it. I think there's other parts of the economy where people have had a really challenging time. I think of logistics, where what's going on with Royal Mail, I think, is probably causing a lot of thought in the private sector for anyone who works in logistics, again, which is a big employer. And we know that there's whole parts of the economy where trade unions don't have enough of a foothold. So I think the challenge is, how do you make sure that unions are modern and flexible and appropriate? That idea that, you know, you can strengthen your position at work by working with people in the same position is still true. Like, it's a simple and still true idea. It's just that how we do it is undoubtedly going to change with the way that workplaces are now.
I think there are two big structural changes going on. One is the shift from manufacturing labour to the service sector. And the trade unions have been at their most powerful and influential in the manufacturing era. They haven't really, they found it harder to transition to a service-dominated economy, harder to operate in the service world. And secondly, within that transition, to refer to the title of this podcast and the title of your book, The Nowhere Office, you know, that service sector is becoming more and more discombobulated, more and more spread around. And trade unions tend to operate best when people are in physical contact with each other, when labour is agglomerated together, and now labour is moving apart. So I think the Nowhere Office is a big challenge to trade unions as well as it is to bosses.
Talking of flexible working space, Stefan's cat has made an appearance and is meowing, and I hope that our editor does not lose that, because it sort of slightly speaks to exactly what you've been articulating, Alison. But isn't, I mean, Adrian, I know you wanted to come in, perhaps a charge against the unions is that they're not actually, despite the lone signal man or woman, as agile, to use a horrible corporate word, as they like to think they are. By which I mean, I don't think trade unions have necessarily embraced distributed networks in quite the same way that, say, social media has. I mean, Adrian, what's your, give us a little, as the Americans say, pushback. Give us some pushback on Alison's utopia.
Let me start off by saying that I really agree with her on about one thing, and I think it's a very important word, which is attractive, the attractiveness of work. What we saw during the pandemic was a revelation, really, to us, that a lot of people really don't like work. They're not that they're lazy and they don't like working, but the way that work has been structured has been antithetical to people's interests. They didn't like the 9-to-5 and they didn't think it was worth all the commuting, and they were proved to be right on the basis of that. They didn't like the way they were being, you know, treated as instruments of corporate will, told what to do. They wanted to be in charge of their own timetables, their own affairs. And again, they proved during the pandemic that you could actually maintain or even increase levels of productivity by working at home, by being much more in charge of your timetable, by being able to break up your day in your own way. And I think that the natural instinct of bosses is to be a bit suspicious of workers, to try and monitor everything that they're doing, to try and, you know, move towards a peace payment sort of system, ideally. You know, you produce the work and they pay you, that sort of thing. That's their attitude. The attitude of trade unions is to think, how can we fight back against this attitude? How can we establish the rights of various groups? How can we negotiate better pay? I think we need to have a much more focus from employers, from trade unions, on how to make work more attractive, both more attractive to people so it fits in with their lives, but also, you know, we have this extraordinary problem of the number of people in this country who are just dropping out of the labour force. They're not working, they're not claiming benefits, particularly affects men, but it also affects retirees. They just don't think work is attractive enough to do things. So how we could really collectively sort of break out of this capital versus labour mindsets and think about how to work make work attractive. And that's something that the pandemic actually did by accident, and we ought to be trying to do it on purpose.
How can we make sure that the conversation continues in that direction, Adrian and Alison? How can we make sure that it isn't becoming too highfalutin and too theoretical? We were in Vienna recently, weren't we, Adrian and Julia, listening to Gary Hamel, among others, our favourite guru, and he talked about dismissively what he called the laptop class. This is a laptop class discussion. And he meant a little bit high level and not perhaps real and down and dirty enough. How can we keep the conversation real about work?
Well, I think I would start by separating out of the people that Adrian mentions. There are, you know, inactivity is rising, the employment rate is below what it was before the pandemic. There are people who have chosen not to work who were working before, but those people are quite varied. And people retiring early, if they can afford to, are not necessarily the people that I would spend my time from a matter of public policy thinking about. But I do really want to think about, as Adrian said, making work attractive for people who do want to work, they do want to have a job, but not now. And there's quite a lot of people, what the Centre for Cities called last week, the involuntary inactive people. And, you know, that is people for whom ill health has been a problem, and also lots of parents. Yep. So in some ways, Stefan, I think it is brass tack stuff. I think it is focusing on having a childcare system that actually functions properly, because that doesn't just help parents, it also helps grandparents. And I think it is also saying, okay, what's your workplace wellbeing policy look like? What happens if somebody does have anxiety or depression? You know, how supportive is that environment? How attractive is it? You know, I suffer from chronic migraine, and, you know, I can think of lots of ways in which a workplace would be attractive or unattractive to me. And I think being specific about ways in which businesses can help make their workplaces good for people will help them recruit, and it will help us deal with our inactivity problem. I can't see a reason against it. I don't even think it's party political. I think it's just that the government ought to play a role in leading that.
One nuance. Which is that, you know, trade unionism and trade unions are increasingly things that are found in the public sector, not the private sector. You know, private sector trade unions have been contracting enormously. And so far as trade unions have sort of kept up their numbers, it tends to be in the public sector. So you, as the next government, will be dealing with trade unions as employers, as it were. You will be the bosses and they will be the workers. And so you will have to do things like trying to constrain the growth of public sector wages, because we won't be able to afford exactly everything that people want. So won't that turn you into, you know, the big bad wolves of this, to refer to Martin's book earlier, and not the sympathetic people who want to keep everybody happy?
Well, yeah, I mean, any Labour historian will tell you that any Labour government becomes that. But your hope is that you do good things and make a difference. And as I said before, like, contribute to that institutional change.
Just to push that a bit more. Wouldn't it be a fantastic thing for a Labour government to do, to be inventing or promoting new ways of working in the public sector? You know, things that make work more attractive as well as more productive, reorganising work rather than just thinking about workers' rights.
I think one of the things that we just don't talk about enough in relation to the NHS crisis at the moment is what work is like for people in the NHS at the moment. It's far too stressful.
Sure.
So I think if we can have more staff in the public sector and at the same time reform and change that makes the quality of work better, as well as thinking about those infrastructure issues about how we make it easier for people to do more at work, then I think we can have a reform agenda that works. Of course, it needs to work for the people who are using public services. These long waiting lists are just terrible for everyone at the moment, but we haven't talked enough, I don't think, about what work is like at the moment for people who are under quite a lot of pressure.
These are the big questions. I think in the private sector, every bit as much as in the public sector. In fact, our partners on this programme, Prospect, of course, very active, dealing with problems at Twitter in ongoing, usually constructive conversations with National Air Traffic Control and so on. So it's actually universal. And that's what's been so helpful and illuminating to get from both of you today.
So to help us sift through what we just heard, we asked Andrew Pakes of Prospect, Deputy General Secretary, Director of Communications and Research, to give us his impressions from this second programme about the workplace's future, whether it's looking fragile or fraught, secure or insecure.
Well, firstly, I think there was some really good contributions across the piece today, and I hope our listeners agree too. Everyone who spoke in some way touched on what I see as three of the really big emerging themes we need to get the balance right on in the future of work. And to me, that's around time, space, and reality. You know, we started at the top of the programme with Hafsa Begum looking at the office redesign that we're doing. And that really addresses the idea of space. And it's not so much just a binary divide between are we working from home or are we working in an office. I think there's a much more creative discussion we're now beginning to enter into, which is about how does space support us? What is the purpose of our workspace? What facilities do we have? How does it support our well-being? How does it encourage productivity and collaboration? And we need to think creatively about what that space is for and how we relate to other people, not just the location that individuals are sat in. Secondly, there's this question of time. And to me, this is really opened up post-pandemic, and we need to keep mining at it. This idea that we're not just there to work ever longer hours, trudging to work, doing our hours and coming home again. We've now got a space that's opened, which is around renegotiating those boundaries. Now, there's huge positives, which is actually we can use our work to be more productive, but also get greater enjoyment and well-being in our downtime. But there's also risks, and that risk of the always-on culture, that we could end up just stretching our working days. We've really got to get real, like our contributors have said today, in terms of what does this all mean for grounded policy. As Alison McGovern and Adrian Wooldridge discussed, there's a contract that continually evolves between government, business and workers, whether in the public or private sector. You know, these are new forms of the same debate we've had in the past, even if some of the component parts look a little different.
Well, thank you, Andrew. That's Andrew Pakes there. And to all our guests today, Hafsa Begum, Jamie Suskind, Alison McGovern MP and Adrian Wooldridge. You've been listening to the Nowhere Offices special edition in association with Prospect, the trade union, and you can find out more on prospect.org.uk.
And we will be returning to our special series with Prospect, looking at work through the prism of trade unions. And in the third and final in our series with Prospect, which will be in a few weeks' time, we'll be joined by, amongst others, Baron Hendy Casey, John Hendy, one of the leading legal eagles of his generation.
I suppose the obvious thing standing back from it is the change in the balance of power between workers and employers. When you look back to the 1970s, getting on for 50 years ago, 3/4 of the workforce were unionized and 85% of the workers had terms and conditions which were decided by negotiation between unions and employers, not necessarily their union, or even they might not have been in a union, but settled by agreement and negotiation. And nowadays, that percentage is certainly less than 1/4 of workers whose terms are settled by collective agreement. Most workers don't have any negotiating levers to pull. So their terms and conditions are set really by a unilateral diktat by employers. That's a fundamental change. And that's the reason why, you know, the recent statistics showing that we've got well over 1 million workers now on 0 hours contracts who don't know how many hours they're going to get in a week or how much pay they're going to get at the end of the week or even how many hours or how much pay they're going to get today or tomorrow, and the feeling of insecurity, and of course the issue which is uppermost in everybody's minds at the moment, the disparity between wage increases and the cost of living.
And you know it by now, the Nowhere Office, nowhereoffice.com, is a fully connected production hosted by me, Julia Hobsbawm,
and me, Stefan Stern.
Do find out more by going to prospect.org.uk, and we're at thenowhereoffice.com. Bye-bye.
Cheerio for now.